From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a centrist Republican who wants his party to move back to the center. We talk with Richard Darman. When he served as budget director, he convinced President Bush to break his pledge and raise taxes. Darman also served in the Reagan administration, although he says he failed the ideological litmus test. He's written a new memoir. Also today, intervening in homes where parents beat, mutilate, or kill their children. We talk with Mark Parent about his years as a caseworker with New York City's Emergency Children's Services. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the music of Italian pianist Sergio Fiorentino. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Two Air Force B-52s are being reassigned to the Persian Gulf area following a new provocation by Iraq's military today. Pentagon spokeswoman Deborah Bosick.
Early this morning at about approximately 3:55 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, two United States F-16s received radar indications of an SA-6 launch. That's a surface-to-air missile. The aircraft visually observed a missile being launched from the site, and a second missile was fired from the same site. Both missiles missed.
The missiles missed their mark because the Iraqis turned off their ground-based targeting radar just after the missiles were fired. This was apparently to prevent the F-16s from firing retaliatory weapons that would lock onto the radar and destroy the missile facility. B-52s were used to launch last week's cruise missile attacks against Iraq, but one senior Pentagon official says Saddam Hussein apparently thinks the U.S. will not strike him again. Hurricane Hortense is being blamed for at least 8 deaths now in Puerto Rico. The storm dumped 20 inches of rain and destroyed over 650 homes there. At least 1,000 people have been left homeless in the Dominican Republic. Forecaster Michelle Huber at the National Hurricane Center says the storm is now lashing the Turks Islands.
A hurricane warning is in effect for the Turks and Caicos Islands and the islands of the southeastern Bahamas. We have hurricane warnings in effect for the entire north coast of the Dominican Republic. And we have a hurricane watch in effect for the central Bahamas.
National Guard troops have been deployed in Puerto Rico to prevent looting in flooded areas. Forecasters say Florida appears to be safe from Hortense. The storm will probably be kept off the mid-Atlantic coast by a weather trough that's now off the coast. Forecasters say it will likely be pushed northward, possibly targeting the Northeast and New England states later this weekend. The United Nations General Assembly has adopted a resolution banning all nuclear weapons testing. It's the first global ban since the U.S. carried out the original nuclear test in 1945. The BBC's Rob Watson reports from the UN.
The vote was enthusiastically welcomed by most delegates, among them the U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Madeleine Albright.
This was a treaty sought by ordinary people everywhere, and today the power of that universal wish could not be denied.
Although India and Pakistan need to sign the treaty for it to come into legal force, diplomats expect most countries to abide by its provisions anyway. They also believe neither Delhi or Islamabad will want to defy the will of the international community against testing. Some diplomats are already setting the next target for arms control, a treaty that would get rid of nuclear weapons altogether.
The BBC's Rob Watson reporting. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 11.5 points in light trading. You're listening to news from NPR. GOP presidential nominee Bob Dole returned to Capitol Hill today to tell Republican lawmakers not to get jittery because polls show him trailing President Clinton. The former Senate leader said the election will come down to trust, and he claimed that people cannot trust Mr. Clinton. Dole accused Democrats of preaching fear, and he said he is still confident he will win in November. New Hampshire Republican Congressman Bill Zelif has lost his bid to become the state's next governor. New Hampshire Public Radio's Laura Canoy reports.
Zelif could have easily won re-election to a fourth term in Congress. Instead, he decided to run for governor in a wide-open Republican primary. Zelif was the front-runner until the very end, but his rival, State School Board Chairman Ovid Lamontagne, ran an energetic, aggressive campaign and came out on top.
Conventional wisdom and the pundits said we could not win. We would not be able to raise the required resources, and we wouldn't be able to energize our voters. Tonight, as a team, we proved those pundits wrong.
LaMontagne ran as a strong social and fiscal conservative, and some Republicans worry he might be too conservative. They fear LaMontagne's primary victory on Tuesday will mean a victory for the Democrats in November. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy in Concord, New Hampshire.
A new report just released by the Federal Reserve shows that the nation's economy was expanding moderately as summer was drawing to a close, but the report hints that a growing wage inflation problem is existing in many regions of the country. Parents in the Rhode Island town of Westerly are upset after a crop duster mistakenly sprayed homes and two schools with insecticide. The state began spraying this week to kill mosquitoes carrying a potentially deadly virus. A new study by the American Hospital Association finds that the number of Americans with health insurance is on the rise. Nearly 40 million people have no medical coverage. Among the reasons cited are more people working part-time and more people working for more than one employer. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Richard Darman is not the most popular member of the Republican Party. Darman helped convince President Bush to break his Read My Lips pledge and raise taxes. At the time, Darman was the president's budget director. Now Darman has his doubts about the Dole tax plan. Darman has also served as President Reagan's deputy White House chief of staff and deputy secretary of the Treasury. Darman describes himself as a centrist, who often wondered how he ended up working with the more ideologically driven conservatives in the so-called Reagan Revolution. He's written a new memoir called Who's in Control? Polar Politics and the Sensible Center. He says that many members of the Reagan administration used ideology as a litmus test to separate the good guys from the bad guys, and Darman couldn't pass the test.
Curiously enough, part of the litmus test that was applied way back then was whether you had supported Ronald Reagan as early as 1964, and I failed that test. I also probably failed some of the elements of the ideological test itself. I was not for some of the constitutional amendments that defined the Reagan right at the time. I had not fully agreed with some of the Reagan policies in California with respect to welfare reform. So there are a number of issues on which I didn't pass the test. But I think the most serious offense in the minds of those who were applying the test was that I was associated with a moderate Republican, sometimes thought of as a liberal Republican, Elliot Richardson, with whom I was proud to have been associated, I should say. But nonetheless, in some people's minds, that was disqualifying.
In your memoir, Who's in Control, you write that the Reagan Revolution was more rhetoric than reality. How so?
I distinguish between the programmatic elements of the Reagan Revolution, balancing the budget. He didn't balance the budget. He said he would by 1983, and of course we know he had multi-hundred-billion-dollar deficits that carry forward right till today, and reduced the federal debt. It increased radically, passed constitutional amendments to ban abortion or allow school prayer. Those never moved forward through the system at all. So on down a long list of programmatic elements. He did get a major tax reduction, but he also increased taxes in 1982, 83, 84, 86, 87. People tend to forget that. So the programmatic elements of the Reagan Revolution were largely unfulfilled. I do think he succeeded in a different sense that might be considered revolutionary, and that's not programmatic so much as it is a matter of national spirit, national self-confidence, national pride. He restored all of those. People sometimes forget that in the 70s, America had an awful lot of self-doubt. There was talk of our being in decline as a society and as a country, of malaise. There was a sense that we couldn't accomplish anything, that presidents couldn't get anything done, that somehow the political system itself was fundamentally flawed. Within a very short period of time, President Reagan helped restore a national sense of confidence. I think that's his most important contribution, and I think it's a contribution that would justify an important place in history.
Well, let's look at the economics of the Reagan administration. You say, you know, that President Reagan really wanted to cut big government, and that, you know, quote, big government had been at 22.9% of gross domestic product at the start of the Reagan administration, and it was shrunk by 0.8% to 22.1% at the end of the Reagan administration. And you write, during the Reagan administration, the government grew to a scale larger than it had ever reached before. Federal spending reached 24.4% of the gross domestic product, a new and still unsurpassed peacetime high. Do you think the Reagan administration was responsible for creating more debt? Is the deficit that we have today, in part, the fault of the Reagan revolution?
No, I think there's fault to go spread in a lot of directions. Maybe we shouldn't call it fault. Let's just try to look at it analytically. Part of the problem came from the tax cut, the size of the tax cut. The tax cut was actually larger than President Reagan himself asked for, and that was because of a political process in the Congress that became a bidding war, including many Democrats in Congress bidding for popularity by gifts to the public in the form of greater and greater tax increases. Second part of the problem was that the Congress provided only half the spending reduction that President Reagan had asked for. And so the program was out of balance because he overachieved on the tax side thanks to the Congress, and he underachieved on the spending side thanks to the Congress. But you have to remember also, Paul Volcker was chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he was on a campaign that was ultimately successful and very important to radically shrink the hyperinflation of the 70s. He did so very, very fast. That exacerbated the problem of the recession, deepened it. In fact, the second deepest in the 20th century. The only deeper was the Depression. And that, of course, cut the revenue base enormously and increased spending for entitlement programs. So there's a number of contributors in this equation.
You helped convince President Reagan to raise taxes several times during his administration. In fact, you're right that you thought some of the tax cuts were a mistake all along, yet you helped push them through.
Well, I thought that the tax cuts would make sense if they could be balanced by equivalent spending reduction, offsetting spending reduction. And my assessment was that the political system was not likely to provide that amount of spending reduction. I think with the benefit of hindsight, people would agree. The political system for all these years since 1980, right to the present, has been unwilling to cut spending to anywhere near the degree that it pretends it's willing to do so. And as long as that's the political reality, deep tax cuts, which will not fully pay for themselves, are going to contribute to a deficit problem, that is, unless spending can be brought under control. So it was not because I don't think there are favorable effects from lower tax rates. I think there are. In fact, I worked for lower tax rates very hard in 1986 and successfully so. But I think it has to be managed in a way that keeps an eye on the need for fiscal balance at the same time. And the process was not balanced in 1981.
You were President Bush's budget director, and as everybody knows, President Bush, when he pledged no new taxes, read my lips, no new taxes, and you were one of the reasons why he ended up raising taxes. You really encouraged him to go through with that tax raise. How did you make your case to the president when he knew that he had so much on the line in not raising taxes?
Well, it was becoming increasingly obvious that the fiscal situation was not getting better. The economy was not strong. The Federal Reserve had kept money tight, and the economic growth that had been forecast was not as great as people had hoped or thought it would be. Almost every independent analyst and our own government analysts was forecasting much higher deficits than had previously been expected. And there was a provision of law at the time that required automatic spending reductions across the board if you were unable to achieve the deficit reduction targets by legislative action. That was known as a sequester provision, a word which hardly anybody pays any attention to. And most people, I suppose, don't even know of or care about. But at any rate, had that gone into effect, there would have been enormous cuts in, among other things, defense expenditures, and it was at a time when Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, and there was a U.S. buildup underway for what ultimately proved to be the successful effort in Desert Storm. But in that context, the national security community, I dare say most of the public, would have been unwilling cut a giant swath through the Defense Department just as they were preparing to send men and women possibly off to their death in battle in the Middle East. And And so there was a need to negotiate some form of compromise. The Democrats controlled both houses of Congress. We negotiated the very best deal we could get in that circumstance. The president didn't have the luxury of a Republican-controlled Congress, as has been recently the case. And all things considered, I think President Bush quite courageously went ahead and did what was known by him to be politically, potentially self-defeating. But he did what I think was the right thing for the country in the context. Would I have preferred a different and better deal? Of course. Would he? Absolutely. But was a better one negotiable in the circumstance? I personally doubt it. Indeed, I might say the bipartisan leadership of the Congress were all party to the negotiation, and with the exception of a single individual, every single one of them, Democrats and Republicans, felt that they'd negotiated a good and the best possible deal. It so happens that because it turned out to be quite unpopular, very few of them seem to remember that they were party to the negotiation.
When President Bush lost his reelection, did you feel partially responsible for that because you had pressed hard for the tax raise?
Well, I certainly have thought about it and worried about that a good deal, and I'm naturally defensive, I suppose, on the subject, and I've got an awful lot of arguments which can allow me to tell myself that I was not really responsible, and I think on the whole, I believe those arguments, but still it's a cause of some personal worry in my own part. I would feel very badly, and from time to time, I do feel badly at possibly having contributed to the president's loss. I do think, however, most importantly, that he did and we did the right thing in the historical context.
Let's look at what the presidential candidates are saying now about taxes. Bob Dole pledges to finish the job Ronald Reagan started so brilliantly. That's a quote. And he's calling for a 15% across-the-board tax cut and 50% cut in capital gains tax, plus balancing the budget in 5 years. Do you think that can be done?
I think that the math as presented by Senator Dole works on paper. And I might say as an aside, President Clinton's math works on paper. I think in political practice, both programs, the Clinton program and the Dole program, assume more spending reduction than the political system has shown a willingness to give. So in that sense, neither one of them is being realistic. They both gloss over the question of what to do about the so-called entitlements programs, the big middle-class entitlement programs of Social Security and Medicare especially.
Now, what's your analysis of President Clinton's proposed tax breaks, tax credits?
Well, hesitant to say, but basically I can't think of an alternative to say they're political gimmicks, by and large. I mean, take the one, for example, supposedly support tuition for junior colleges, first two years of college all across the land. Is that really going to benefit individuals, or is that all going to go to expand two-year colleges who will raise their tuitions? Will it end up in people's pockets, as he pretends, or will it end up somewhere else? And if you said, given all the problems with the American education system, if we had all that money to spend, would we really want to go spend it for 2 years of junior college when we got a whole bunch of people who can't even pass fourth grade reading and a mathematics test? We have a very fundamental problem of primary and secondary education in America that itself demands a major reform effort. And I think the tax thing that President Clinton has proposed is sort of Ross Perot called free candy before elections. It's a distraction.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Darman, and he's written a new political memoir called Who's in Control? Polar Politics and the Sensible Center. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Richard Darman, and he was President Reagan's Deputy White House Chief of Staff and Deputy Secretary of the Treasury. Under President Bush, he was Budget Director. He's not in politics right now. He's written a new memoir called Who's in Control. In your memoir, you describe yourself as a centrist who ended up in the Reagan administration, surrounded often by people who were much further to the right than you were. I'd like you to assess the Republican Party for us now from your point of view. Where is it politically in between the center and the right now, and what direction do you see it heading in, or what tug of war do you see happening now?
I think it's in the middle of an enormous tug of war, and the outcome is uncertain. I think the Reagan coalition, that where President Reagan came to power in 1980, was extraordinary and not to be carried forward. It rested on some peculiar historical circumstances. A large portion of the sentiment that led to President Reagan holding on to blue-collar Democrats and some white-collar populists who were not normally Republican was really anti-Carter, or it was a new sentiment concerned about changing American values and the erosion of American confidence and so on. There hasn't been a candidate, not likely to be a candidate, who can hold that kind of coalition together going forward. And so you've seen the old Reagan coalition coming apart and a struggle among its different factions for the right to lead the new coalition. So we have supply-siders and we have social conservatives and we have a very shriveled branch of traditional moderates within the Republican Party. And of course, as is often noted, the primary process tends often to include the kinds of people who are more strong, some would say extreme, in the views that they hold, and to discourage or exclude people who are somewhat more moderate. And I think moderates in the Republican Party have been left somewhat disenchanted and feeling that they're either not represented or they're, for one reason or another, best inclined to sit on the sidelines.
How do you feel as a moderate?
I'm at the moment just observing the phenomenon. I regret it. And I think there will be, but I can't prove or demonstrate, I think that there will be a substantial centrist revival. Of course, we're seeing it in the current election, but I don't take that too seriously. Both candidates are posturing for the center because the center is where you win or lose in American elections in reality, and they recognize that at the moment. But the question is, what's the governing majority, which is different from the issue of what do you do to win an election? How do you govern? To govern effectively, you need a strong and stable center and a coalition built from the middle outward, not from some extreme towards the center. I think Colin Powell, to a degree, represented the kind of person who could build such a new coalition from the center. There probably will be other figures between now and 4 years from now who will rise to prominence and visibility, trying to organize a new centrist coalition. Bill Clinton, of course, himself started out in before 1992 to run as a new Democrat, supposedly going to build such a new coalition. But then he, upon being elected, he turned way to the left and came up with this Clinton magazine or health plan that alienated almost everybody, even within his own party, and failed to build that new coalition. It is still there to be built. The question is, who is going to build it? I don't think anyone has command of a natural governing coalition at the moment. The system is in flux.
As a self-described centrist, I'm wondering about your impressions now of Newt Gingrich's image. I mean, during a couple of years ago, all the Republican congressional candidates were trying to ride on his coattails, and now everybody's trying to distance themselves from him.
I think that there's an irony of sorts here in that Gingrich is fancies himself as, and to some degree he has been, a master strategist. But at the moment of his own rise to the greatest power and visibility, which I think was late 1994, when he'd been elected, re-elected, it was clear he was going to be Speaker, and there was this enormous media attention. He had an opportunity at that point to think strategically about broadening his own base. And he's the kind of person who would think that way. And for some reason I don't understand, He decided not to do so, but to tie himself to the narrower base of the House of Representatives, the right flank within it, and the narrower agenda of the contract with America, or for America. And in the process, he took what might have been an historic opportunity to rise to even more power and create a new majority, somewhat in line with his own thinking. He took his own popularity, or the popularity of those he was associated with, from near majority or majority down to 25-26% by having this much more narrow focus and base. It was a surprise to me that he missed that strategic opportunity, because he has fancied himself such a strategic thinker, and in fact has been a strategic thinker for most of his career.
So you see his position largely a function of strategy as opposed to deep belief and commitment?
Yes. You have to remember, he was originally a Rockefeller Republican. He doesn't advertise that, but he is a more complicated person in his thinking than simply a straight, by-the-book, simple conservative. There are areas in which he believes that government should importantly play a role, and at times in his career, he's reflected that. He's for government investing in technology and research and infrastructure. He gets infatuated, I would even say, as do I, with these things at times. He has found it convenient, certainly from the standpoint of preserving his power as Speaker, to put any trace of that aside and to stick to the narrow agenda. He would have been more successful, in my view, if he'd been willing to lose a little bit of support on his right flank and broaden his base, and I think go with his more natural inclination towards a more creative middle. He didn't do it. I suspect he may have lost the opportunity forever, because certainly it's very difficult to recover from the low popularity that he's driven himself down to.
Richard Darman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Richard Darman's new memoir is called Who's in Control? Polar Politics and the Sensible Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, taking children away from their parents for the children's protection. We talk with Mark Parent, who spent 4 years as a caseworker with New York City's Emergency Children's Services. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a CD by Italian pianist Sergio Fiorentino. We're listening to music from it now. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mark Parent has had to take children away from their parents for the children's protection. That was part of his job during the 4 years he was a caseworker at New York City's Emergency Children's Services. When it was started in the 80s, it was the only agency that operated at night, investigating allegations of child abuse and removing imperiled children from their homes. Caseworkers like Parent were asked to follow up on tips that were phoned in by neighbors, psychiatrists, friends, and family of victims. Parent's new memoir, Turning Stones, is about what he describes as his trip through the darkest basement of human behavior, where parents become perpetrators, mutilating and sometimes killing their own children. I asked him how he'd announce himself when he showed up at the door to investigate alleged abuse.
Well, you end up being a bomb diffuser. That's what I felt like after a while, because, you know, the saying that you get more with sugar than you do vinegar is really true. And I'd knock on the door and tell people where I was from, and we had a flimsy plastic card that we would hold up to show them that we were for real, which didn't always work, but once they saw that we knew the names of all their family and the ages and their previous addresses, they figured that we were for real. And I'd start out by just telling them what the allegations on the report say and let someone know that this is what somebody said about you, and we're here to hear your side of it. And even if none of this is true, isn't it a good thing that we're here checking it out, because we don't know that it's not true. And for people that had something to hide, they would stay angry. And the people that actually were reported falsely, I could get them to understand that isn't it a good thing that we came out in the middle of the night within hours of getting this report. And they'd say, yeah, sure.
So what criteria were you supposed to use to decide whether a child was in jeopardy?
It was simple. When we went in the middle of the night, we would look in the situation. If the child was in trouble, we would take them. If the child was safe, we would leave them. If we weren't sure, we would take them.
Oh, God, that must be so hard. I mean, you walk in there, you're strangers, you don't know these people. You get to spend, what, a few minutes with them to evaluate. How can you feel confident in your judgment?
We left situations that were not ideal. To be followed up by daytime officers who would take their time and analyze the family and try to figure out what sort of help they needed. But it was simple to see a child that was in terrible risk of harm. If you're in the bedroom sitting on the bed of a child who's covered with cigarette burns, it's a simple thing. I saw kids like that. We took those kids and had parents arrested.
There's a case that you describe that where a baby died and you felt that you had made the wrong call and felt very guilty for a long time. Tell us a little bit about what happened there. Let me say that this was a case where you were told that there was a mother with five kids and that the kids were running around wild and unclothed and undernourished, and you went to investigate.
Right. This was at the end of a long night of visiting other cases, and towards the end of my time with the agency, and went up into a home where there was minimal furniture, very bad building. Every other apartment was abandoned and padlocked shut. The type of a building that felt ridiculous to go and check on the safety of one child when it seemed like everyone in the building was unsafe. Went into the mother's apartment, and she was doing her best with the resources that were available to her. She wasn't a bad person. She wasn't a neglectful person, but she was a person in the middle of a terrible building with no money and too many kids. And so that was taking its toll. She had just had a baby that was just a few days old, and we took a look at it. In the report, it said that the baby appeared to be thin and weak. We took a look at the baby. We asked the mother to take the baby out of the crib that she had, and we looked at the baby, and we didn't look at the baby close enough. And I can tell you what we should have done, which is take the baby out of the blankets and gave it a thorough look and if we had any questions, take it to the emergency room to have people who are qualified make a decision about if the child was sick or not. Anyways, there was mice in the apartment. There was a lot of children. They were running everywhere, touching us and grabbing us, and there was a lot of distractions. We ended up leaving the family there, and writing on our report that somebody should follow up right away to check on the safety of all the children. The office that I worked on had a mandate to ensure the safety of children for a time period. So the infant survived our time period of responsibility, but died right after that and before the daytime office could follow up. And the cause of death was failure to thrive syndrome. Baby wasn't taking in nourishment. The baby was too thin, the baby was weak, and the baby died. And we were officially exonerated, but I did feel responsible personally for not taking action that night.
Tell us an example where you really did feel like a hero, where you felt confident that you'd saved a child's life and that the intervention was an important and good thing, an intervention that saved a life.
There was the first case that I write about happened shortly after I was hired, where two boys were left alone, left in their home alone. The case was called in by a child psychologist who was seeing the older of the two children, and she was concerned because when the children were left home alone, the older child became fearful and had in the past made overtures to try to kill his younger brother. And so she called the home, found out that they were left home alone, and gave us a call. So I called the home and talked to the child for a while, and he was a neat kid. And I just asked him point blank if he ever feels like he wants to hurt his younger brother. And he very honestly said, oh, yes, absolutely. He said sometimes it was hard to resist his urge to kill his younger brother. And I talked to him about that a little bit, and it turns out that there was drug dealers in the hallways of the project that he lived in. And when he heard them in the hallways arguing or doing deals, he was afraid of them for good reason. And so if the younger brother would make noise, he was afraid that the drug dealers would come in and hurt he and his younger brother. So basically what ended up happening is in the course of a few moments, I was started out just having a conversation with a young child, and noises did start to come out of the hallway, and the boy did become afraid. And it very quickly, the situation turned on its ear, and I was in a situation where I was talking to a boy who was holding a knife to the neck of his brother's throat. My supervisor called the police, and I had to keep him on the phone and try to keep him from cutting his brother's throat until the police came. And they did come, and he didn't cut his brother's throat. But I'm certain that he would have, because he had the knife on the little boy's neck, and the little boy was screaming. And he was I was talking him out of pushing the knife into the boy's neck. So that was an evening that, where I went to bed that night feeling like I had done a good job and that I'd prevented something terrible from happening.
My guest is Mark Parent. He's written a new memoir called Turning Stones. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Parent. He spent 4 years as a caseworker with New York City's Emergency Children's Services, investigating allegations of child abuse and taking away endangered children from their parents. I'm wondering what it was like for you to work at night. You were often going into very unsafe housing projects in which there was a lot of gang activity and drug dealing, and places, well, unsafe places tend to be, I think, even more unsafe at night. And also, I don't know, a lot of us just have feel more vulnerable at night. It's dark. A lot of people are sleeping, and a lot of people who are awake are carrying out nefarious activities. And it's just the night just is eerier than the day. So what was it like for you to do this work at night?
One time it hit me really hard when I was in the middle of a bad case in the middle of the night, and I was working with detectives and police, and I was in a lobby of a project at about 4 a.m. and realizing that I was the only one of the large number of people standing around that wasn't carrying a gun, including probably most of the people that were just civilians in the hallways. Yeah, it was a very scary job. It was really my first real job, and so I didn't have anything to compare it to when I was thinking about what I was doing. But towards the end of my time there, I started to think, you know, there are people who go to work every day who aren't worried about getting a bullet in the chest, and I really had periods, and we all did, and the people who work there still do have periods of actually being afraid of being shot at or stabbed or attacked. And it's something you take for granted if you have a job where every day you don't have to face that kind of fear. That was a very real part of this job.
And you probably had no protection, no bulletproof vests, no guns?
Nope. No. At one point when I first joined, I was going to get a vest just because it seemed crazy to go out and take someone's kid away and then walk slowly away from the building. And even when you weren't taking a kid away, you were not a popular character walking away from there.
No, you're worse than the repo man. I mean, you're repossessing the kid.
Right. I mean, and that's as crazy as people get. I mean, I say in the book that taking someone's kid is a little easier than ripping their arms off, which is, I believe that. I wanted to get a bulletproof vest, but then everybody in the office didn't have one, and I don't know. I was 24 years old, so you live forever when you're 24.
Were you ever hurt or threatened?
I was threatened all the time. I was never hurt. If you were good, now I don't want to say that people that get hurt are not good, but I think that you can get yourself out of a lot of situations by being the bomb diffuser. I went out with people who were confrontational in their style, and they were at much greater risk of getting slapped around than I was. I respected people. I respected their homes. I respected the job that they did up to this point with their kids, and I was honest with them. And it was amazing how often I had situations where I was walking out of a home, taking somebody's child with them thanking me. And when that would happen, I would really say, wow, you know, this is incredible. And I knew that it was because of the care that I'd taken with the person and because not getting personal with them, but just saying just getting them to look at the situation and just respecting them.
What kind of person would thank you for taking away their child?
Somebody who's so caught up in the throes of drugs that they cannot keep their family running. I would take someone into their kitchen and ask them, how many kids do you have? And say they say four. And I'd say, then let's look in your refrigerator. And we open it up, and there's nothing in it. There's a bottle of juice. There's a half full box of cereal. I say, so how come there's no food here? Well, because that's a question they would not be able to answer. And say, how many other parents with four children have cupboards that look like this? these are people that are getting money, public assistance, and have food stamps and are using it for other purposes. And just being honest with someone and getting them to look at their situation, I would end up saying, listen, we're going to take your kids and you're going to get yourself together, hopefully, and do it for your own, for your children, so that they can come back to you. But these people weren't idiots, and a lot of them could see that that of course their children were in danger. I would say, imagine if it wasn't your kids, but somebody else's kids, and say, yeah, I can see why you're here, and I can see why you're doing what you have to do.
Would it sometimes amaze you that a parent who had burned their child with cigarettes all over the child's body would still really want to keep the child? A parent that was willing to physically mutilate or destroy their child would be offended if you tried to take the child away and wanted the child to stay in the house.
Yeah, well, there were situations. There were situations where you had varying degrees of sympathy for a parent. And I had kids that I went to go see that had cigarette burns. And I've never seen a kid get burned with a cigarette. But if you can make yourself go to that place and imagine it, you get a lot of anger that wells up in you. And anger is a self-indulgent emotion that doesn't really do anything in the situation for the kid. So I try to go ahead and get angry when I'm home at night and not on the job. But I didn't have a lot of sympathy for those parents, and I would, so that was a different situation.
Would you wonder, though, why they still wanted the kid around? Why would they fight to keep the kid if what they wanted to do with the kid was hurt him more?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for a lot of these people, their kid is the only thing that they have, and the kid continues to love them through all of it, and they need to be loved, and they need to, they need all of the things that they get from their kids. The love, they need to dominate over someone. They need it's sick. It's a twisted psychology, and I didn't even care to go there. I didn't care. If there was a kid with cigarette burns, then I'd let everybody else go ahead and talk about the reasons and what's going on. I didn't care. I'm just going to take the kid out of there.
Did children ever say thank you? Or feel glad to be taken away from their parents, even when their parents were hurting them?
Yeah, very, very rarely I had children who were thankful, and it's really a sad thing if a child is thankful that you're pulling them away from their parents. So it was a strange mixture of emotion that you'd have with that. Mostly, even with severely abused kids, they were... they wanted to be with their parents. I mean, think about, everything that your parents do, you think that every other parent is doing. I mean, if you grow up in a house where mom and dad are walking around on their hands, then you just think that that's what people do. And so the things that these kids were subject to were not unusual. And there's, even in the worst situations, there's periods of joy and love and familiarity, and there's the siblings, and there's the four walls that you know, and the school you like to go to, and they lose all of that when they get removed.
Well, Mark Parent, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Mark Parent's new memoir is called Turning Stones. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says that one of the high points of his summer was the concert he heard at the Newport Music Festival by 68-year-old Italian pianist Sergio Fiorentino. Lloyd says he was eager to hear that concert, and now he's eager to tell us why.
Sergio Fiorentino was born in Naples in 1927. By his 20s, he was winning all sorts of awards and touring the world. He made his Carnegie Hall debut in 1953. The following year, in South America, the plane he was on crash-landed. He survived and even continued to make recordings and give recitals. But his spinal injury and general disenchantment with the life of a performer led him to devote himself to teaching. After he retired from the Naples Conservatory in 1993, he began to perform again. The British label Appian released a spectacular live recording of performances he gave in Germany. His recital this summer at the Breakers, the hideously lavish Vanderbilt mansion in Newport, was his first return to this country since his American debut 43 years ago. Fiorentino is a small, elegant, dignified man, which makes the scale of his playing seem even more remarkable. Effortlessly and stone-faced, he produces overpowering tone of phenomenal, you might even say moral, authority. It's hard to escape the term golden age because there's hardly anyone else alive who has his particular lost combination of the heroic and the exquisite. On Sergio Fiorentino's live CD is Schumann's C major fantasy, in a performance that's uncanny in its play between outward and inward drama. It starts by weaving a quiet, suspenseful tale of bravery and romance, but becomes increasingly personal, Schumann's own story. Calm resolution is shattered by a heroic ceremonial march on the grandest scale. Fiorentino ends the second movement with a cast of thousands finale. But the quietude of the last movement seems even more daring. Fiorentino takes his time, spinning out strands of pearls and diamonds as a delicate, rippling accompaniment to a plaintive song, a lullaby that evolves into a song of sadness and loss. Memories of great deeds past subside into an acceptance, and in the last chords, an affirmation, a reminder that all we have of value is the song of that inner life. include Fiorentino's own arrangement of Busoni's arrangement of Bach's D major organ prelude and fugue, sonatas by Beethoven, Chopin, and Scriabin, and a breathtaking sequence of waltz transcriptions, paraphrases, caprices, and metamorphoses. Hummingbird trills, stupefying octave runs, and climactic Chico Marx glissandos are the least of what Fiorentino impresses us with. He reminds me of Rachmaninoff, whose recordings, Fiorentino says, meant more to him as a student than his actual piano lessons. He knows everything a waltz can do. His playing is not merely bravura, but a subtle toying with our expectations, teasing, nostalgic, tender, and diabolical. Godofsky's symphonic metamorphoses on Die Fledermaus becomes a serio-comic nightmare in which snippets of those famous Strauss waltzes surface and dissolve in some inebriated, maniacal whirlwind of ungraspable memory. In Fiorentino's amazing hands, this waltzing becomes as serious and scary as Bach or Schumann.
Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Sergio Fiorentino in Germany on the Appian label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Barbara Bogave and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Alan, too, directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we revisit the O.J. Simpson trial with Jeffrey Toobin, who covered the trial for The New Yorker and has written a new book. He reports that Simpson failed a lie detector test and was leaked the verdict before it was delivered in court. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.